Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. Now we're joined by Richard Glohr. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at KU, and his research on lizards has led him to believe that our understanding of which animals are in the same species has been maybe not quite right. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
We'll get into the discoveries about species shortly, but let's start with lizards. How did you get into lizards? And I mean, like, really into lizards.
Well, there's not an easy answer to that because I've been interested in lizards for as long as I can remember. I think most of us that are in this field that I work in, herpetology and biodiversity more generally, we're just fascinated by organisms and biodiversity. And so in many cases, we've just been doing it for our whole lives and just kind of transitioned from kids who are flipping over logs and finding frogs to people that are working in molecular genetic laboratories discovering new species.
What interested you when you began observing lizards in the Dominican Republic? Because it sounds like that's where you started, and you started there very young. But I'm curious about what intrigued you about these lizards in particular.
Yeah, I did start there kind of young. We have some great programs for undergraduates to do research through the National Science Foundation. I was able to travel to the Dominican Republic for the first time when I was 19. And one of the things that fascinated me about the lizard that I still study today is as a 19-year-old, I was doing some surveys in a national park. And I saw that if I just walked a couple of kilometers, the appearance of these lizards completely changed. And in particular, they have this flap of skin on their throat called the dewlap that they extend. It's colorful. They use it to display to potential mates and rivals.
Is it the thing that looks kind of like an Adam's apple, but just huge?
It kind of looks like an Adam's apple, but it's not actually like an apple. It's more like a flag. So it's just a flap of skin that they have a ligament that they can extend they literally signal like a flag.
Off of their necks.
Yes. Yes. It's on their neck. You may have seen them. Big iguanas will have dewlaps. There's lots of lizards that have these, but anoles really have developed them to a very fine degree where they have very species specific colors and patterns as well as displays that they use to show these dewlaps to one another.
So take me through your mental process as you begin to zoom in on these particular lizards in this particular place with this particular neck flap.
Well, initially, as a young student, I just saw this as a curiosity. I thought, why do they have orange dewlaps here? And then I get on a boat and I go 2 kilometers away and they have yellow dewlaps. And I thought, well, doesn't this defy or cause problems with mating? If you have the wrong color dewlap, maybe you're not recognizing your mates. And I've spent a good part of my career trying to answer that question. Why do they have different dewlap colors in these different localities that are so nearby?
And so the identifying mates thing, is that a big deal? Because of we've defined a species as if you're in the same species, you can create offspring that are also fertile.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the big criteria that people use to define species. Biologists have argued for a long time about what even a species is. So how do we go out in nature and identify species? And it turns out that the big part of the problem is that species are one of these things that they form continuously and kind of drawing a line. Think about it like, how do we decide when a human is an adult? Is it when they hit puberty? Is it when they get a driver's license? Is it when they move out of home? So we can argue about where exactly we draw that line, but everyone agrees that humans form adults. And species are kind of the same thing. So for many, many decades, we've had this challenge of just how do we recognize species in nature?
And so you think that your lizards in the Dominican Republic complicate that?
I think they don't complicate it. They add this fascinating dimension of being able to study how species is occurring through actual investigation of organisms in nature. So the advantage of seeing these populations that seem very similar, except for, say, one trait like the dewlap, is that these seem like young species. And for previous generations of systematists, this was seen as a challenge and a complication.
So like young separate species.
Yeah, so species that are on their way to becoming new species, but may not be as deeply divergent as, say, a horse and a donkey are. This is the famous example of if we mate a horse and a donkey, we know they're different species because we get sterile offspring when we cross them. There are lots of species that just haven't gotten that far in the process. Speciation takes millions of years. And that's what these lizards that I study makes them so fascinating for me, is that we can investigate this process by which new species are forming.
What have you found as you've investigated that? I mean, I don't know how old you are now. You seem significantly older than 19, though not quote unquote old.
Thanks. It's good not to look like I'm 19. Yeah, we, myself and other folks in speciation research have made a number of really exciting discoveries recently. And one of these is that once we use molecular data, once we get data about our genomes and the genomes of organisms, it turns out there's a lot of species out there that we didn't see before. So think about an example where if I put four glasses of soda in front of you, let's say I put a root beer and a Coke and a 7-Up and an orange Fanta, and I say, how many different kinds of soda are there? You might say three. There's two brown ones, a clear one, and an orange one. And then I say, okay, well, now taste the sodas. And you taste them and say, holy cow, these two brown ones are totally different from one another. Root beer is completely different tasting than Coke. That ability to taste the sodas for you is kind of like our what the insight that we're getting from molecular genetic data. It's a whole nother layer of insight on what a species is and how they differ from one another. And some species we just can't see with our eyes. We can't distinguish them easily by looking at them. We need some other form of information.
So does science have an agreement on how different two species need to be on a molecular level? Because I have really always just heard this definition about you mate, you create fertile offspring, you're the same species, you mate, you don't create fertile offspring. Sorry, no dice.
Yeah, and I think that that's an attitude that a lot of people have, and that's what you learn in biology, introbio. We teach this, it's called the biological species concept. If things can't cross with one another, they're different species. If they can cross, they're not different species. And what I always like to ask my students in when I teach herpetology, for example, I'll say, hey, how do we describe species? And they'll give me the answer. And then I'll show them a description of a new species, and I'll say, show me the part of this paper where somebody crossed different species to ask if they're interfertile or not. No one ever does that. So that's really just a criterion that is kind of idealistic and philosophical and maybe theoretical, but it can rarely be used in nature. And moreover, one of the big insights we're getting from new genomic research is that lots of young species in nature are still crossing. There's still a relatively low degree of interfertility. And that can be very useful to a species.
How?
So this is it's a kind of a difficult concept to explain, but it's one of the greatest insights we derive from genomic data, which is parts of the genome can move between species and some parts can't. So to give a kind of cultural analogy, think about there's a million people in Kansas City. And suppose
there are 2 million.
2 million. Okay, let's give Kansas City 2 million. And let's not argue about how many are in St. Louis, but let's say there's 2 million in St. Louis too.
Okay, let's just say that.
And let's say there's people moving back and forth between Kansas City and St. Louis all the time. But let's imagine that, let's say 10% of each population, 200,000 in Kansas City, 200,000 in St. Louis, are huge baseball fans. Those folks in Kansas City are Royals fans. Those in St. Louis are Cardinals fans. As long as those people are there, the city, the culture of the city, assumes this fandom of the Royals or the Cardinals. And as long as those people don't move that much between the two cities, we're still going to maintain this distinctness. And those are like the parts of the genome that maintain species distinctness in the face of gene flow. And the advantage of that for a species, just like for a city, if you're Kansas City and you want some more people that are good computer programmers, maybe you steal some from St. Louis. Or if St. Louis needs some folks that are Masons, maybe they'll steal some from Kansas City.
But the ones from Kansas City need to become Cardinals fans, and the ones from St. Louis need to become Royals fans?
No, as long as analogy may break down. But the basic point is that as long as we have this core group of people that define the culture of Kansas City and St. Louis as distinct, we can maintain this distinction in spite of a lot of sharing happening. And that's what happens with genomes. We have parts of the genome that maintain the distinctness between species, whereas other parts of the genome may be shared between species.
So this is how we are close relatives of fruit flies, even though we would not recognize them or invite them to, like, dinner?
Well, we're rather distantly related from fruit flies, and I don't know if they'd make a great dinner companion, but we certainly have a lot to learn from fruit flies. And fruit flies are a major area of research in speciation because we could dissect this precise genetic basis. And this insight that I'm talking about, which parts of the genome are moving between populations, was derived initially from work that was done in the laboratory with fruit flies. And what my research is trying to do, and a lot of other researchers now, is trying to combine that insight from detailed genetic experiments in laboratory organisms with insight from animals in nature that are actually undergoing this process of speciation.
So in the Dominican Republic, you are exploring all of these really heady ideas by looking at lizards. Can you take me to one of these like observation moments, because you do your work in the field. And I'm curious, like, yeah, take me there with you. Where are you going? What are you doing? What are you looking at?
Well, we have kind of two exciting things that will happen in the field. One of those is, which is much rarer than the other, is when we actually find a new species. And so biologists will have occasionally moments in the field where you see a new organism and you just immediately know that it's new and different. And that can't be rivaled among biologists, I think, the excitement of discovering a wholly new species. And this has happened recently in the Dominican Republic. We've discovered a giant new lizard in a very well-explored area in a very unusual kind of forest that just wasn't found before because it's incredibly hard to find.
What does it look like?
It looks like lichen. It looks like a gray twig covered with lichen. It's beautiful.
Okay, well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for this morning's conversations on KCUR's Central Standard. Richard Glore with KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Good luck to you as you continue to change the way we think about species and look at your beautiful lizards in the Dominican Republic.
Thanks, Gina. It's great to be here.
If you missed our discussion about what it means to be presidential with the director of the University Press of Kansas, you'll find that along with this conversation about lizards and biology online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, a Lawrence company making a talking house got us thinking about how technology in the home affects life beyond the home and has done that historically. That's tomorrow at 10. Don't miss it. We're at KCURCST on Twitter. You can talk to us there anytime. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.